America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. Organized labor has taken a real nosedive since its heyday in the 1950s and 1960s. I remember watching Face the Nation and Meet the Press. You'd always see a great labor leader like Walter Reuther from the United Auto Workers on these programs because they had a lot to say about the economy. But with the descent of organized labor came levels of economic inequality that have been really hard to remedy. Now workers are in greater demand than in the recent past, and many are not willing to settle for any job at any pay. Unions in the private sector are reemerging and strengthening. There have been a number of strikes and new organizing efforts in many sectors considered immune, like the tech industry. What does all this mean to the American worker? Find out today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Peter Berg. He's a professor of employment relations at Michigan State University. He's also the director of the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations at the same fine institution. And we brought him here to talk about the fact that it seems as if labor unions in America, which have really been beaten upon and really diminished over the recent period, are having a moment. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah, I think it's accurate to say. I mean, what's interesting is last year, Gallup did a poll that showed an approval rating from labor unions at 68% in the population, which was the highest rate since 1965. And interestingly, among Democrats, it was at 90%, and among Republicans at 47%. But that trend has really been climbing since 2009. And so the public is recognizing at least some approval and role for labor unions in society.
What surprises me is that there were a lot of people thinking that the younger workers, because they're so independent, they're in the gig economy, many working as independent contractors, that they really didn't want to have anything to do with something that sounded as organized labor. And yet I'm reading that they're some of the highest in terms of approval ratings for labor unions.
Yeah, it's interesting in that young people, the experience with labor unions is pretty low. And I think, you know, directly that because unions represent around 9% of the working population, that a lot of young people have limited exposure and may not fully understand what labor unions do economically. But I think what they see is issues around social justice, issues around worker rights, civil rights, where they see representation and a union movement as an important actor that can be helpful in this regard. And so the appeal of unions is broader than simply their economic mission of representation at a workplace.
Well, I think many of us have seen that there have been these upheavals of late. 100,000 unionized employees have overwhelmingly voted to authorize strikes, and workers in very different kinds of categories across the country, from automobiles to tractors, John Deere, Kellogg's, Frito-Lay, newsrooms like the New York Times. It's kind of surprising the breadth of labor activity that's going on.
Yes and no. I mean, I think labor activism has increased, but we're also in a situation where we have a tight labor market, where demand for workers is exceeding supply. And so you have an issue where workers are in more of a power position. And so I think unions are capturing some of that power and using action like strikes or other forms of worker action to either negotiate or force employers to provide better working conditions. That when you're in a situation in a tight labor market, the fear of replacement workers, that is, if you strike, firms have the legal right after a period of time to fully replace all the strikers with new workers. Well, in a situation where it's hard to find workers, that is less of a threat. And that emboldens, I think, unions to pursue strikes and other forms of action as a way to get changes in working conditions. And particularly, oftentimes there's been a building up of unhappiness, mm-hmm. but now in a power position, it's time to exercise a strike to actually get some action to make a change.
Can we divide the private union development and activity that we're seeing from what's been going on historically in the public sector? Because they're two very different stories, but I think it's important to lay that out.
Public sector unionism has typically been much higher. That's been where the strength of unions have been. There's been less labor strength in say, retail sectors or other sectors. It's been declining in certain areas as the labor force has grown. Representation hasn't kept pace. But public sector has been the strength. You don't have the same kind of competitive pressures in the public sector as you do in the private sector. And so unions have tended to been able to obtain working conditions that are fairly stable with good benefits, higher wage premiums, higher benefit premiums in the public sector. What's happened, though, over time is there's been a passage of what's called right-to-work laws, where it's harder for unions to essentially, I guess, organize, and this has really now come over, it's really come to the fact where certain states have made it hard for unions to actually collect dues automatically from employers as well. So there's been an undermining of union rights in the public sector in the last several years. Where we're seeing a lot of this activism, though, more recently is in private sector work, particularly in areas where you see shortages, food service, hospitality, healthcare. That's where some of the big shortages of workers are. And so you're starting to see that a bit more now.
And what did the pandemic do to hasten or at least turbocharge some of this activity?
I think the pandemic really forced people to reflect in a way that said, what are my priorities? What do I really want to do? I mean, you've heard of this term, the Great Resignation, where people mm-hmm. exited the labor market. We've seen women exit the labor market and say, no, I'm not going to work under those conditions, or I want to take care of my kids, or I've been at home now. I want to keep doing that if I can for a while. And I'm more concerned about the conditions I'm going back to work in. And I've read even that some workers are like, you know, I need a new social contract if I'm going to go back to work. I want more flexibility. I want those terms to be different. I want to incorporate remote work and a hybrid working schedule if I can. So the set of demands to bring people back in the labor market is also changing. I think that's been significant. And frankly, I think employers aren't quite sure yet what the right model is and how to handle it.
Amazon is, of course, a major corporation whose workers also provided an essential service to Americans during the pandemic. I think a lot of people were surprised very recently when a union at Amazon on Staten Island, a warehouse, decided that they wanted to form a union. What kind of signal did that send, and how unique was that enterprise? I read where the guy who organized it, Chris Smalls, he was really dismissed, I think, by the leadership at Amazon or the management group, thinking he didn't have the capability of starting his own union. He did it on his own.
I think this really sent a big signal that Amazon, and essentially with all the resistance they put into that they still lost the election. Now, a couple of things about that election. One, he had looked at what existing union was doing in terms of organizing and decided, no, we're going to be an independent union. We're not going to go with an existing union. we're going to be an independent union and do more of a campaign that was tailored to that particular location, building up trust, building up credibility. He was a worker in that facility and took the time to do that in a very sincere way. His view, I think, I had read was that, you know, existing unions didn't understand the situation. And I think he was underestimated clearly by Amazon as someone who wasn't a seasoned union organizer. But yet he was able to do that, I think, because of his sheer perseverance and sincerity with the enterprise. Now, the thing about Amazon is, like any time you organize, you can win an election as a union. And in the United States, in order to for workers to be have the right to be represented, they have to win. They've got to win a majority of the vote to exercise that right. That's a high bar. That's very, very hard to do. And once you win, it's only about 25 to 30% of all victories don't get a first contract. So there is a substantial amount, say a third never get, or just less than a third, never get a first contract. So you can win the election, but now the employees will look at you and say, okay, we've won. Where's our union? They're going to negotiate a first contract. Well, a third of those elections never result in a first contract. Why? Well, employers can use various tactics of resistance. They can appeal the election on various grounds. They can stall a negotiation. They can make it difficult to negotiate and delay negotiations and delay until workers then say, well, look, it's been a year or more. We still don't have a contract. What was the point of this? We're not going to support the union. So there are still tactics that Amazon, like any other organization, has to use to prevent unionization. And this is what makes it so hard in the United States to win unionization. We've had court cases over time that have given employers various rights to resist unionization through captive audience speeches, bringing employees into a conference room and telling them all the reasons they shouldn't vote for a union without having to provide time for the union to give their side. So there are many tools that employers have, hiring union avoidance firms and things, and that just makes it very, very hard to win representation.
Well, when you look at it, let's be very blunt. It's a political process, and there have been moments in American history, and I think the recent one has been one of those, where labor was not really in the lead. In other words, Republicans had really nominated a lot of people to various positions in the judiciary and other places, and they were somewhat hostile to unions. Now, of course, the Democratic Party, and I've been going back because I'm doing a podcast on the history of the Democratic Party, and it's fascinating to see how much the fortunes of the Democratic Party in the 20th century were totally aligned with the fortunes of a biracial organizing effort among workers, white and black workers. That's when the Democrats have had their greatest moments and greatest strength. So now we have a Democrat in the White House, and brief, perhaps, moment when it controls the Congress. How important is that?
I think that's very important. I mean, unions, Joe Biden's been very clear about his support for unions and sees them as legitimate actors in society, not as sort of third-party interlopers into the enterprise. And that, I think, gives unions a sense of, it gives them access to the executive branch. It gives them a voice in politics that they haven't had necessarily of presidents in the past. But it's a short window, and I think you're right about that, that unions often will gain strength at different times. And what we haven't seen in the United States is that strength leading to legislative change. So we still are operating on legislation from the 1930s in how unions win representation. And that was a completely different economy built on large organizations, not on smaller, more divided organizations where, you know, the retail shop has to vote for a union. Well, to win representation from every Gap store or every Amazon warehouse is very, very difficult to do. It's very different than organizing all of General Motors in one vote or a large auto plant with 10,000, 20,000 workers. So I think that you have this window, but you have to exercise it, and it's very difficult to turn it into legislative change.
Why have the Democrats, I don't think, really offered anything that updates the National Labor Relations Act? Or, well, of course, you got to help us understand the National Labor Relations Act in the New Deal and the first major revision of that, the Taft-Hartley Act. So what are we operating under today in terms of organizing efforts?
So we have the National Labor Relations Act, which is about private sector organizing. And then we've had subsequent acts that came prior to 1960, really, that were revisions in some ways of that. And some of those gave different rights to employers as a result of that, of those acts. Some of them had to do with how boycotts were done and other things. But the main piece of legislation remains the National Labor Relations Act. And what it says is you've got to go through a process of a vote that's certified by the National Labor Relations Board. And that vote is held and taken. First, you have to show that there's an interest among employees who are willing to entertain a vote by the part of your union. That's the first step. And then if they are, you get a third of those employees that say they are. You schedule a vote. And after the vote, if you win a majority, you get to begin negotiations on a first contract. The difficulty becomes in that there have been court decisions to interpret what the rights are of unions and employers. And courts have typically given more rights over time to employers to oppose unionization. And so it is through those decisions that employers have, don't have to allow union folks on their property, don't have to give equal time. They are able to provide employees with lots of information, as I said, through meetings and mandatory meetings and other things to vote against them. Unions have to go essentially house to house. They need to work on a strategy often off-site. So it's like political organizing, and that it's difficult to do in the face of opposition. And employers often will cross the line. They might fire people who are union organizers, knowing that the penalties associated with crossing, doing an unfair labor practice, are not that big for big, big companies like Amazon or others. So that process, which is unlike anything else in the world, very different, is you have a right to a vote, not a right to representation. And so the difficulty that makes for people to get a voice in the workplace means that it's very hard for unions to grow in a sense of their coverage across the labor force.
Peter Berg is our guest, a professor of employment relations at Michigan State University. What about the National Labor Relations Board? Who is that made up of?
Yeah, that's typically a political appointees. So the executive branch is in power. As those people come up for renewal, I think there might be three board members that are appointed by the executive branch. And that board tends to be more political. It swings from Democrat emphasis to Republican in terms of the appointees. What you have there is they will make determinations on whether someone has violated or performed an unfair labor practice. They will certify an election to make sure this was done correctly. There's often a time, a concern is when someone shows that employees are ready to vote. How long does it take before you can get a vote? And it's interesting that in Canada, some provinces will say, well, you know, it's 5 days. You got to make that happen in 5 days between when employees say, I'm ready to accept this union and vote on them, to when that vote is held. And typically in the U.S., it's a month. And that is a period of campaigning. So it's been recognized that that period of campaigning really gives both sides, but much more heavily tipped towards employers, the opportunity to campaign. And while that's seen as a way of free speech and people should have the right to put their views forth, it's also a very political time when both sides are maybe investing a lot in putting out mixed messages or only their side of the story.
I had a friend who was a political organizer in Boston back in the 1980s trying to subdivide portions of Boston from the rest of downtown, and he wanted to call it Mandela Mass, and they got it on the ballot twice, not unlike what we're talking about here, union organizing. But I said to myself, if there were social media when this gentleman and a partner of his were trying to make this happen, I thought that the chances would have been much greater that it actually occurred, aside from just getting on the ballot, which itself was a remarkable thing. And in reading about Chris Smalls at Amazon, he used a lot of non-traditional means like social media outreach and the old-fashioned on-the-ground organizing. It would seem to me this is a new era. These are new workers, as you say, many of them not really skilled in understanding what a union does for you or how it does its business, that unions are going to have to reconsider how they both approach the process of organizing, but also how they actually represent people. It would seem as if we need a new model for them, too.
One, I think social media is really important in organizing, and what you're right about a new model. And what has been happening, it's kind of prior to the very tightening of this labor market, is people have been exercising their voice, their ability to stand up and say, I want to change in the kind of conditions I work under. And if I can't get it by electing a union at a single workplace to negotiate an ongoing contract, then I'm going to pursue it through state legislature or a city council and get a living wage ordinance, or I'm going to protest and try to persuade employers to act unilaterally to make changes through political protest, so that the exercise of voice on work is taking now many, many different forms. It isn't just the channel of a union representation. And what I think, you know, is happening is as the economy has become more diverse, our channels that have allowed for worker voice have not changed legally, but they have changed a lot in terms socially. That is political protest, civic unrest, civil rights demonstrations. We're expanding the notion of what it means to have good working conditions and a decent wage and benefits and other things. And if we can't get them, I think this is what workers are saying, if I can't get them through electing a union, I'll choose other tactics. And those tactics, by and large, tend to be political. And they can lead to change, but the change will not be as consistent or steady as a contract. What unionization gives you is an ongoing contract. If you get that first contract, you now have the right to renegotiate, and you have stability. If I change a law, a new legislature can get rid of that law, you know, say at the state level or at a city level. So we're getting into, you know, maybe more incremental changes, but not reforming that very strong, cohesive kind of model of voice at the workplace.
I just want to make certain that people understand who are listening, who may be younger, that we're talking about 1954. At the peak, the union movement had organized 34.8% of the private sector. Now, of course, we're down to 10.8%. I think that might even be inclusive, I don't know, of public sector, because
yeah,
I thought it was closer to 6 or 7% in the private sector. But
yes,
with all of that said, there are three factors that I'm reading that are affecting what's happening. A renewed respect for essential workers in the wake of the pandemic and all the pandemic-related reshuffling of lives, soaring company profits, and, of course, the new political will in Washington. Would you say that those are probably the three things that are really working toward a greater effort at organizing?
I think those are important. I'd also add in the labor market, the fact that a tighter labor market, the fact that demand for workers exceeds the supply, and that workers are using that power to exercise more organizing, and where you see the strike activity as well. That is an important factor. You know, you can have essentially issues of political support is important, but that labor market really forces employers. And unions are saying to them, look, we know you've been making profits. It's not true of every organization or some industries, but for a lot of industries, they've made profits over the course of the pandemic. So this is the time we're going to exercise our labor power through the labor market to ask for part of that.
Apropos to what you said earlier and what we were discussing, I'm reading where Adam Seth Litwin, who's a professor of industrial labor relations at Cornell, said, workers are right to think the ball is in their court. they need to take a really big bite of the apple right now, because whatever they get, they're going to have it in their mouth for a long time. We know how quickly fortunes can change. It looks, unless something happens and inflation kind of washes away, we could have a change in the party structure in Congress almost immediately, and that would, of course, change a lot of people's thinking about the impact of having a favorable position in Washington.
Certainly agree with my friend Adam about that. I think that's absolutely true, and I think it's one of the concerns workers could have out there is if inflation's going to bring about a recession. You know, if we hit a recession and demand for labor drops and people come back into the workforce and supply still grows, that's going to relieve some of the pressure on employers. And so, you know, that is part of the danger. I think workers are right to act now. They're acting out of their position of power as employers would do, you know, and have done over time. Again, I think what they're trying to do is get what they can get now, knowing that there have been years when they've had not been able to get things to improve. Wages have been stagnant for lots of industries for long periods of time, and so employees are trying to make up some of that ground. And inflation is also contributing to that. You know, there's also a danger. Unions have to be careful all the time. In if you ask for too much or if you push up wages too much, there can be secondary effects. So that, you know, either public backlash, or you're contributing to inflation, or employers in the next round say, well, it was too high, the costs have gone up, I can't afford this, you know, and layoffs happen. So there's always a balance between what you ask for and the amounts you ask for, and it's, sometimes it's hard to know exactly what the right area is.
And I wonder whether the messaging of somebody trying to either organize a new union or really make an existing union more active and more aggressive is, look, you have lost a lot over the last 30 years, and we're going to really push hard in this moment when we have something of a movement to really go forward and try to get you either back to where you should have been because wages have not kept up. We've all talked about income inequality, or that I'm going to really push you ahead. I mean, what is the message that you think many of these unions are offering to workers?
I think that is part of it, that unions can show evidence that there's a premium for being in a union. People make higher wages and they have better benefits on average if you're in a union versus not in a union, and that we will use our collective strengths to negotiate better benefits for you. I think a lot of it comes down to respect, that you need to exercise your voice now, and people want respect from their employers, and they've either not felt it, and they want a union to bring about, help them get that respect and get changes in their contracts, wages, benefits, flexibility, other things that they haven't been able to get on their own. And I think it can be a powerful message for people, particularly people who are, you know, saying, I've worked here for a long, long time and nothing's changed. So I want to try this now.
And, of course, the Democratic Party really does have, the benefit, ultimately, of having more organized labor if they can get it, because they do act as political workers, if you will. They're out there during campaigns. So what is the Democratic Party doing at this moment? Because I think their fortunes are tied to a lot of what we're talking about today.
Yeah, I think Democrats have typically used organized labor as a way to help get out the vote and to do that. I think it's sort of a mixed blessing for Democrats in that, you know, they often can talk to union leaders for support, but when it comes down to membership votes, the membership can be very different if they tend to vote on cultural issues versus economic issues. And you find that you're not really getting all the members to vote Democratic in different unions. I think it really depends on the types of unions you're looking at and the messaging that the Democrats are appealing to those particular groups. Democrats, I think, will continue to use unions as helpful vehicles for political get-out messages.
Now, the unions were responsible for moving a lot of the fortunes of factory workers from the 50s to the 70s. Do you think unions can provide the same boost for service workers that they provided for manufacturing, or even for tech workers, for that matter? Again, we see some organizing going on at Alphabet, Google's parent. Do you think that that is a sector that is ripe for unionization?
Talk to people in Microsoft, and they are really looking at and anticipating greater union organization drives in technology areas. And I definitely think we will begin to see more and more of that as tech workers see unions as people who can, as groups that can help them, and as they get more comfortable with the idea of unionization. And there, you may have a better chance to organize people into these clusters of workers than, say, a service sector where tenure might be less, the average size of the organization might be smaller, and it's harder to organize piece by piece. I think that could definitely be a future. I think healthcare is another area that is struggling right now, and unions still have a lot they can do in the healthcare space.
Is there anything else about this trend in organizing and labor relations in America that you think we haven't touched upon today that you'd like to?
You know, the other thing I would just say, and it's something that I say to my students a lot, is that we have, in the United States, we have really given ourselves one channel for representation at work, and that is through unionization. We don't have any other channels. This is the choice you have to make. It's not true in other countries. Other countries, particularly Europe, might have other channels. And here I talk about something called a works council. That is a representation where you give rights to people at a location, at an establishment, at a particular location. Say you elect a board that has these rights that employers need to talk to them about issues, either consult with them, get their buy-in on things before they can implement changes, say in training or hiring or other things. It's another form of representation that's different than electing a union to negotiate wages. This council or board would only negotiate things on issues that are different than wages, so that you could create other channels for employees who are maybe uncomfortable saying, well, I don't know if I want to be in a union setting my wage, but I would like some voice at work, but I'd like more options and more choice. And what's interesting is that choice is typically something that we typically say we value highly in the United States. Mm. You can choose to be represented in the union or not choose, but we only offer one channel. And I've yet to see the debate come forward where we could begin to start and say representation, the ability to have a voice at work, is so important to people. We need to be offering more choice to people as a matter of policy, and let the employees decide then if they want, what channel they want, and what kind of voice they want at work.
I wonder if we're hearing anything from the fact that there was, I believe, a Supreme Court decision that you alluded to earlier where people could give dues to be represented as it relates to the contract, but not for some of the other activities that a union might be involved with. They could say, I choose not to support those activities of a more political nature.
People always had the option to restrict their dues to just the economic, but I think the court decision, I think this is right, was saying that employees or union members are not required to pay any dues. And that's the idea, is that you don't have to pay any dues. That's the right to work state. You don't have to pay any dues. And unions would argue, but I'm providing services.
Right.
And the counter argument was that, yeah, well, it's that you're providing services, but this is their voice. This is their right to choose not to do that. They didn't necessarily vote for you, and therefore they shouldn't have to pay for a union to do that. And so that, I think that is where particularly public sector unions in various states have seen that lack of financial support. There have been some decline in financial support, as some folks have said, well, if I don't have to, I'm not going to pay anything.
And you still have to represent me at the
bargaining
table. And
you are legally, employers, and this is the thing about unions, they are legally obligated to represent them. And it's also true that if someone files – a grievance and says, well, this aspect of the contract was not done correctly, the union is obligated to take that grievance and to decide the extent to which they will pursue, whether that goes to arbitration or how they will resolve it. So unions have legal obligations to serve their members, but in these cases, you know, the courts have said, well, but the members don't have any obligation to actually pay for it.
In closing, with a Supreme Court that will be decidedly more conservative for a long period of time, unless something untoward happens, I guess the question is, can they expect to get any relief from any of the changes that might come out of many of the states in America that clearly don't want to help the organizing effort?
Yeah, I'd be very surprised if this Supreme Court in some ways turns to issues that would favor unionization. I think when we look at the court system in general, courts tend to support property rights, that is, the rights of owners who have the property versus, say, the rights of a stakeholder, like a worker or a community that has a stake in that business. Those are different rights versus the right of the property owner says, look, I own the business, I should be able to control all these aspects. And courts have tended to side more with the property as a form of voice than the stakeholder as a form of voice. That's different, again, in other countries where stakeholders are afforded more rights than we afford them in the United States.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. A lot for us to think about. Peter Berg is with us from Michigan State University. I thank you so much for joining us today to talk about this very important trend in America here on America Trends. Thanks again.
You're welcome. Thanks very much.